Thank you for tuning in to episode 224 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast using iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. prn.fm has voicemail, so call 862-800-6805, and as well as a message or question for the show, leave your name and make sure you indicate that it's for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners, so don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com. That's LIBERAPAY, where we are also known as Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on any topic you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And this week, we certainly have a good package of feedback. A guy going by the name Fakeologist via email said, "Great show on fluoride. You are doing important work." Somebody with the even more impenetrable name of VJKW8V via the Podbean website just said about the fluoridation episode 222, "Very good." Jean-Marc wrote about viruses. "I'm very happy with this no-nonsense humbleness. We still do not know and cannot see what happens on the very small level on the border between living and dead, quote, things. Let us scientists be more humble and admit, in case of doubt, that we do not know. And sometimes we never will. What we call viruses is some natural and useful mechanism on the level of cells, protoplasm or cytoplasm, in-out core functioning, acid level of DNA or RNA, in plants as well as animals, and more specifically, the human kind of animal. And we already may state that childhood diseases may even be essential for the growth of intellectual development, but let us be more careful with statements that it is, quote, scientifically proven. Thank you from the deepness of my heart and from the best part of my brain, which is still less than our unconscious level of knowledge. It is not easy to speak words when we try to become more objective in these times of lower scientific education, despite hours of school and, quote, painless education. Thank you for those kind words and thoughtful words, Jean-Marc. Mindy wrote about Tim Noakes, episode 219. "Thank you so much for getting Professor Noakes on your wonderful program. The keto diet has saved my life. Professor Noakes is the person with the evidence for humans to eat a ketogenic diet. Grains go back only 15,000 years, but eating meat and fat goes back millions." A couple of comments on Twitter, which perhaps due to the nature of the medium, are a little bit shorter. Barry, "Love the podcast. Keep up the great work." Anita, "Hey, I love your feed." Thanks, everybody, for the kind comments, and please keep them coming. Today, I want to talk about a new United Kingdom hemophilia inquiry. As you may know, I am the president of Rethinking AIDS, and I got that way because I studied the broken science of HIV and AIDS since the late 1990s. I'm not the world's leading expert on HIV and AIDS, but I'm the president of an organization that includes many of the world's leading experts, and many of the experts who aren't on our board are in contact with us. So why is there an inquiry called the Infected Blood Inquiry in the United Kingdom related to hemophiliacs? Well, it's well accepted by most people that during the 1980s, HIV-infected blood was being transfused, and that was the cause of AIDS in people who were exposed to transfused blood. Now, one of the groups that has to be transfused blood products on a regular basis is hemophiliacs. Most require something called factor VIII, which helps their blood clot. And this has been used for many years and has significantly extended the lives of hemophiliacs. So it kind of makes sense that an infectious virus would in the blood supply would cause havoc amongst hemophiliacs because they cannot avoid accepting being injected with blood products. This belief is quite clearly wrong, but it is true that hemophiliacs started to die in huge numbers in the 1980s. So what was going on? It wasn't infected blood, but it was bad blood in a sense, as well as other factors, and I will talk about that when I go through what I wrote to the inquiry. The problem is when several things happen at once. HIV is claimed to be the cause of AIDS. It's claimed to be transfused during blood, through blood. The first drug for AIDS is approved, but that actually doesn't cover all of it. Let's start with the terms of reference of the inquiry. It says, the purpose of the inquiry is to examine the circumstances in which men, women, and children treated by the National Health Services in the United Kingdom were given infected blood and infected blood products, in particular since 1970, including the treatment of men, women, and children who were given infected blood or infected blood products through transfusion or other means, the treatment of men, women, and children with hemophilia or other bleeding disorders, and what was or ought to have been known at any relevant time about the risks of infection associated with blood donations and blood products. So the inquiry is fixated on the fact, on the belief that there was an infectious agent in the blood, a belief that I question, and is not open to other causes such as the medications given for HIV infection or AIDS in the 1980s, or what else was in the blood up as opposed to infectious agents. What else could be in the blood that was harmful that might not be infectious? Similar fixation occurs with IV drug users. It's assumed that HIV is in the blood in shared needles, and then that is how HIV gets between people and causes AIDS. But there is much less attention paid to what's the impact of injecting, say, heroin or cocaine or some other drug for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And more importantly, what else is in the illegal street drugs? People have found shards of metal and glass, bodies of insects, parts of insect bodies. There are probably lots of solvents due to less than proper chemical processes or hasty treatment of the products. So IV drug users are injecting in their bodies many, many toxic and dangerous substances, and yet the entire fixation has always been on HIV. And this is kind of the same thing with transfused blood. Let's focus on HIV and nothing else. And therefore, people who delayed testing blood for HIV are therefore culpable. But what if it was something else that was causing hemophiliacs to get sick? So this is what I wrote to the inquiry. I'm writing as the president of Rethinking AIDS, the leading organization for scientific inquiry of the current dogma that HIV is the sole cause of AIDS. The group was founded in the 1990s by a large group of critics of the rush to endorse HIV-AIDS dogma as fact. The board of this organization includes biologists, chemists, MDs, journalists, and others who are knowledgeable in the field. Our membership includes many HIV-positive people, including hemophiliacs. For privacy reasons, we cannot name our HIV-positive members. Rethinking AIDS is still dedicated to questioning every aspect of HIV-AIDS science, including whether there are cofactors or other causes, whether HIV antibody tests are susceptible to cross-reactions, and whether they can detect infection, whether AIDS drugs extend life and reduce AIDS indicator diseases, and whether HIV can be transmitted sexually via injection of blood products, via dirty needles, etc. The terms of reference of the UK inquiry frequently mention infected blood and infected blood products. We'll limit our comments to HIV and not to hepatitis C or other concerns, as HIV is our main area of concern. There is actually no HIV test that can detect HIV infection, specifically including the antibody tests, which are known as ELISA or EIA, Western blot, immunofluorescence, and also the viral load tests, which are based on PCR. HIV infection can only be detected by purifying particles from the fresh blood of people who may be infected, verifying purification using an electron microscope, and then characterizing the RNA and proteins of the particles. Consequently, we will interpret infected blood and related terms as, quote, blood of people who had reactive antibody tests sufficient to satisfy an HIV testing algorithm. In the 1980s, several things happened which had a significant effect on hemophiliacs, and they are mostly related to, quote, infected blood. These include a transition from medium purity factor VIII clotting factor to high purity factor VIII, the availability of antibody tests claiming to be for HIV starting in 1984, prescription of a wide variety of drugs, including steroids and antibiotics, to HIV-positive people prior to the availability of specific medications, and I might add, afterwards as well, and then the prescription of AZT, which is also known as retrovir or azithromycin, to HIV-positive people starting in 1987, as the first drug approved for treating HIV infection and AIDS. The definition of AIDS was expanded in, well, it was created in 1981 and expanded in 1987 and 1993 in the U.S., with consequent modifications in other countries such as the UK. And I should point out, although it's not directly relevant to this inquiry, that in 1986, the so-called Bangui definition was invented, which was for use in Africa and other third world countries, which is completely different from the definitions of AIDS in developed countries. Finally, the use of CD4 cell counts to guide the initiation of AIDS drugs started in the 1980s and 90s. It is a serious oversimplification to assume that the only factor that created an initial burden of morbidity and mortality in hemophiliacs in the 1980s was HIV infection, particularly when no tests for HIV infection exist. So first, to talk about reactive tests, positive diagnoses, and infection. HIV was first diagnosed in 1984 by an antibody test, the ELISA test, and this practice largely continues today, although antibody tests have become more sophisticated over time. Antibodies at best show past exposure to a virus, not current infection, and over 100 reasons for false positive tests have been identified in the scientific literature. This was compiled by Christine Johnson many years ago. At that point, it was about 75, and around 2011, she updated it to about 100 documented reasons for false positive HIV tests. The CDC has noted that with the ELISA test, quote, false positive reactions have been reported in 19% of people with hemophilia. This was in 1998. False positive tests in hemophiliacs in the 1980s were probably due to high levels of antibodies generated by exposure to impure factor VIII, or what's known as intermediate purity factor VIII, an issue I'll discuss in more detail below. A paper by Kreis noted in 1986 that, quote, HDLV3, which was the name back then for HIV, now known as HIV. So HIV-positive hemophiliac subjects on average had been exposed to twice as much factor VIII clotting concentrate during the previous year as seronegative hemophiliac subjects. This has been interpreted as increasing the risk of exposure to HIV, but it's also compatible with antibodies to foreign blood products being misinterpreted as HIV antibodies. Another scientist, Ludlam, found that, quote, total annual factor VIII consumption was positively correlated with the risk of HIV seroconversion. What I'm trying to say here is that there's two possible reasons why hemophiliacs who received more blood clotting factors, and hemophiliacs vary in the severity of their disease, and those with the more severe disease are infused more commonly, and therefore receive more factor over a period such as a year. So the question is it that HIV was in these in the factor eight, HIV is incredibly non-infectious. That must be true, because if you can be injected hundreds of times and still in some cases not be infected, then it's obviously not very infectious. The other possibility is that the HIV test is really more quantitative than qualitative. In other words, it's reacting to the quantity of antibodies in your body, not exactly what they are. And so therefore, the level of antibodies influences whether or not the test is positive. And in fact, while most people think that HIV tests are positive or negative, they're usually calculated with something like optical density, that is the darkness or lightness of the reaction. And there's an arbitrary cutoff where if it's darker than this, it is considered positive, and if it's lighter, it's considered negative. There's also a category called borderline. And so, for example, if the optical density is very close to the border between positive and negative, and they know that you are, quote, at risk, say you're a gay man or a hemophiliac or an IV drug user, then it will be interpreted as positive. But if you're, a virgin nun living in isolation, then they'll probably say it's negative. Continuing, if some hemophiliacs were indeed falsely diagnosed as HIV positive, they would likely have been treated with AZT and other medical interventions that have significant side effects. Their illnesses would have falsely supported the prevalent notion that HIV was the cause of their illnesses and deaths. So this is what's known in science as a confounding factor. So, for example, we might notice that there is more heart disease as the amount of television watching increases. So we might conclude that televisions directly cause heart disease. Maybe we could get all worried about the RF emissions from televisions. But we might also note that the amount of televisions reflects the increasingly sedentary nature of society. People spend more time sitting on the couch watching television. Televisions reflect the fact that people have more leisure time. Therefore, it may be the lack of activity and the things that people eat when they're watching television that are actually the cause. So you could argue that televisions are the cause of increased heart disease, but they're not the direct cause. So, for example, if a new disease like AIDS is discovered and it's blamed on a newly discovered virus called HIV, and that results in the prescription of new drugs, and if the drugs cause the increasing disease burden, then we might well blame it on the virus when it's actually the drugs that are causing the problem. It'd be an easy mistake to make. There was a disease in Japan, I think in the 1960s or 70s, called Esmon. For years, doctors searched for the bacterial or viral cause for this disease, but it was in front of their face the entire time. It was due to a drug that was prescribed for intestinal problems that actually caused really severe intestinal and neurological problems. According to a 1979 Washington Post article entitled The Japanese Tragedy, the first symptom is usually a peculiar hardening and heaviness in the victim's feet and ankles, as if they were tightly encased in some thick rubber substance. The toes seem stuck together and immovable. The feet feel as if they were strapped into very tight shoes. Later, there are grotesque deformities of hands and legs, accompanied by severe pains. It becomes impossible to walk. Speech becomes difficult, and eyesight begins to weaken, ending in blindness for many. They are the crippling results of Japan's most dreaded disease, Esmon, a nervous disorder that affected thousands here until a household drug believed to be the cause was taken off the market. It is by far Japan's worst drug-caused tragedy, and by some estimates may be the world's biggest drug-induced crippler. More than 11,000 Japanese were damaged by Esmon in the past two decades. In years of litigation against drug companies and the government in 25 courts produced record-breaking damages exceeding $100 million. Subacute myelo-optico-neuropathy, or Esmon, outbreaks in several communities occurred as early as the 1950s. Since then, hundreds of victims have been hospitalized or confined to wheelchairs, and thousands more crippled so badly they cannot work. One out of 20 have gone blind. The cause was identified as clavulanol, a substance used in anti-diarrhea medicines all over the world for decades and said to be still widely prescribed in developing countries where drug regulations are weak. So this is a good example of where doctors went down the rabbit hole of looking for a viral or bacterial cause, which diverted them from the real cause, which meant that possibly thousands of people continued to get ill in really serious ways because they were not looking for the actual cause that was eventually determined about 20 years later. So many years were lost and many lives were destroyed by the delay. And I believe the same thing has happened with hemophiliacs, HIV, and the drugs used to combat HIV, which I believe have caused many of the illnesses that killed hemophiliacs in the 1980s and 1990s. Next, I go on to talk about the purity of factor VIII and CD4 T cell declines. CD4 cells are used in HIV-positive people to determine what's believed to be the amount of damage to their immune system. So a CD4 cell count below 500 is believed to be abnormal, and as the CD4 cell count is lower, 400, 300, 200, 100, 0, then it's believed that the immune system is crashing. And you'll often read in articles that his immune system was destroyed or something like that. It doesn't actually mean that the person was experiencing infections or having any symptoms at all. What it means is that their CD4 count was very low. It's known that CD4 counts are influenced by many factors. Cigarette smoking makes them go up, for example, and vigorous exercise makes them go down. So it's clearly not just HIV that modulates CD4 counts. And it's also not clear that higher counts are always good, because if cigarette smoking makes them go up and exercise makes them go down, then obviously a change in CD4 count cannot be even interpreted as good or bad. Anyway, according to experts from the Royal Free Hospital in the United Kingdom and their School of Medicine, hemophiliacs were switched over to high purity factor VIII from intermediate purity factor VIII starting in 1989 for those with low CD4 counts and in 1991 for the remainder. So what's the difference between intermediate purity factor VIII and high purity factor VIII? Intermediate purity factor VIII is extracted from human blood. So people donate blood, and then through a series of steps, the factor VIII is more and more purified. However, it never gets to a very high level of purity, and the majority of what's injected as factor VIII is, in fact, other parts of the blood. And those can be immunogenic, or they can influence, suppress the immune system. High purity factor VIII is genetically engineered. The protein is manufactured by bacteria, and therefore what's injected is much more pure than the intermediate purity. So calling it intermediate purity and high purity is probably not the best terminology. That's what's used. Anyway, as you can see from the experts at the Royal Free Hospital, the switchover occurred towards the end of the 1980s. This was in the middle of the panic about people dying of AIDS, especially those who'd received blood transfusions or blood products such as hemophiliacs. And it's also notable that the first people to get this higher purity factor VIII were those with low CD4 counts, who were probably those who are more likely to be HIV positive, and I'll explain why in a little bit. So continuing, there's an extensive literature showing that intermediate purity factor VIII was associated with a steady decline in CD4 counts, and that high purity factor VIII largely stopped this decline. For example, a paper by DeBasi reported that in the group of 10 asymptomatic HIV positive hemophiliacs switched to the very high purity factor VIII concentrate, there was no significant change of the CD4 cell counts over the 96-week follow-up period, whereas in the group continued on the intermediate purity concentrate, another 10 asymptomatic HIV-positive hemophiliacs, a highly significant decline was detected. And I cite similar findings by papers by Goldsmith, Hill-Gartner, Schulman, and Ceramitis. And if you're interested in this subject and you want more information, I'd be happy to send you the citations, and in most cases, actually send you a copy of the paper from which I extracted this information. It is important to note that this finding of depressed CD4 counts with exposure to intermediate purity factor 8 was found in HIV negative hemophiliacs as well. A paper by Allardort supports this statement. Even in those hemophiliacs who seroconverted became HIV positive, the decline in CD4 counts sometimes occurred before the receipt of HIV positive blood, a paper by Ludlam. Our finding in this study that T helper cell numbers, which are the CD4 counts, and the helper suppressor ratio did not change after infection supports our previous conclusion that the abnormal T lymphocyte subsets, that's the number of CD4 or CD8 cells, which are sometimes used in a ratio, the abnormal T lymphocyte subsets are the result of the intravenous infusion of factor 8 concentrates per se, not HTLV infection, now known as HIV. A paper by Tsoukas, T-S-O-U-K-A-S, found both HIV-positive hemophiliacs who were not immunodeficient and immunodeficient hemophiliacs who were HIV-negative, indicating that serostatus and immunodeficiency are not tightly related. So I think there is a correlation between becoming HIV-positive and having lower CD4 counts, but it is not an absolute correlation. I think they're both related to the suppression of the immune system or the bombardment of the immune system with foreign proteins. It's known, for example, with regular, say, red blood cell transfusions, that they are immunosuppressive, and this is used by surgeons doing transplants, that the one of the purposes of the transfusions is to suppress the immune system and to reduce the risk of rejection. So intermediate purity factor 8 contained many proteins that were not factor 8, and those proteins may have resulted in a bombardment of the hemophiliac's immune system, therefore a reduction in CD4 cell counts. It's logical to assume that the lifetime quantity of impurities infused with factor 8 would have had an impact on the immune system, and this is supported by the observation that estimated lifetime quantity of factor 8, papers by Kreis and DeShazo, severity of hemophilia, a paper by Evett, and age, a paper by Godert, were associated with lower CD4 counts on average and a greater risk of being HIV positive. So what does age have to do with it? Well, if you're detected hemophiliac as a child and you're now 40, then you've had somewhere between 30 and 40 years of being transfused. If you're a more severe hemophiliac, you get more factor 8 or you're transfused more frequently. So if those are surrogates for the lifetime quantity of factor 8. So the estimated lifetime quantity of factor 8 is associated with lower CD4 counts and a greater risk of being HIV positive, although, as I say, those two things are not tightly correlated. One of the impurities in blood was known as factor 13. Confusingly, they tend to use Roman numerals, so factor 8 is VIII, and factor 13 is XIII, so it's easy to get confused reading and think you're reading factor 8, but it's actually factor 13. According to a paper by Ablin, who is a man that I recently interviewed as he was the discoverer of PSA, factor 8 concentrates in the 1980s were grossly contaminated by factor 13, which is a contributing factor to immunosuppression. So he's referring to the intermediate purity of factor 8. A decline in CD4 cell counts in an HIV-positive hemophiliac would likely be interpreted as the onset of AIDS by a doctor in the 1980s, as there was no way to distinguish a decline caused by HIV from a decline caused by impure blood products, and there is still no way to unambiguously distinguish true positive from false positive HIV antibody test results. A diagnosis of AIDS or a low CD4 count would almost certainly have resulted in the prescription of AZT starting in 1987, the year that it was approved. And I know you want me to start talking about AZT, and I soon will. So it is widely assumed that the increasing morbidity, which just means sickness, and mortality of hemophiliacs in the 1980s, after many years of improving health and a declining death rate, was due to AIDS, a consequence of HIV infection. However, there's evidence that challenged this assumption, including pneumonia was a common cause of death in hemophiliacs prior to the 1980s, according to a paper by Aronson. In other words, the pneumonia being diagnosed as AIDS after HIV testing started in 1984 might not have been different from the pneumonia being diagnosed as pneumonia in the 1970s. Yet it is a dogma that the pneumonia in the 1970s wasn't AIDS because HIV wasn't around, therefore it couldn't have been, even if it was the same. I hope you're not getting confused. Kaposi's sarcoma, some people call it a skin cancer, some people say it's a skin disorder that's not a cancer, but it's quite distinguishable, was one of the first two AIDS-defining diseases along with PCP, type of pneumonia, but was rarely found in hemophiliacs, according to papers by Blattner, Jaffe, and Prinz. Nobody has ever explained how one virus can be capable of frequently causing this malady in male homosexuals, but rarely capable of causing it in hemophiliacs. A third challenge to the assumption that the decline in hemophiliacs was due to HIV: the probability of developing AIDS is related to the type of factor being infused. A scientist named Shania found a 23.3% risk of AIDS over 8 years in recipients of factor 9, which is a different clotting factor, 18.8% for severe hemophiliacs receiving high dosages of factor 8, and 10.9% for those receiving low dosages. The dogmatic assumption that HIV-causing AIDS was the only change affecting the health of hemophiliacs in the 1980s is clearly false and obscures the other factors that were either improving or worsening their health, even without HIV being present. So now, finally, we can talk about AZT. AZT, also known as retrovir and azithromycin, is a nucleoside analog that was rushed through an approval process by the FDA in the United States in 1987 under extreme political pressure. Nucleoside analogs such as AZT interfere with DNA synthesis and thus have a wide variety of side effects, many of them due to the effect of the drug on mitochondrial DNA, which is less protected than nuclear DNA. So if you remember your high school biology, DNA is constructed from four bases: adenosine, cytosine, guanine, and thymidine. And if you were observant, you'll notice that the name of AZT is azithromycin. It is a false thymidine. Thymidine is like a bead that can connect to the chain of beads with two ends. But azithromycin is a broken bead. It connects at one end but not the other. One molecule of azithromycin incorporated in a growing DNA chain terminates the chain. It's known as a DNA chain terminator. So you have a growing chain of beads, one molecule of AZT, it stops growing. So you would expect from that a wide variety of problems in whatever cells this was happening in. Often the cells would die. Sometimes they might become cancerous, or there might be other effects. AZT, starting in 1987, was only prescribed to HIV-positive people. Many years before, it had been tested as a cancer medication, but those days were long over and it had been sitting on the shelf for many years before it was pulled off again by Burroughs-Wellcome, now known as GlaxoSmithKline. Given the fear of AIDS, there was an almost 100% correlation between being HIV-positive in the late 1980s and receiving AZT. One of the most notorious side effects of AZT is anemia, which is obviously particularly dangerous for hemophiliacs. There are too many papers to list, but I have put together an annotated list of citations on the impact of AZT on the blood system. And it's not just red blood cells. It's basically every type of blood cell is destroyed or damaged by AZT. And why is this? Well, because blood cells have to be reproduced on a regular basis. Red blood cells, for example, have no nucleus. They have a limited lifespan, and so the body has to continue to produce them. White blood cells are also continually produced and recycled in the body. So if you interfere with DNA synthesis, you're going to reduce the production of new blood cells, and that's going to cause what we know as anemia. It was noted that the dramatic increase in the death of hemophiliacs was almost entirely in those that were HIV positive, and this is normally ascribed to their infection with HIV. However, after 1987, the majority of seropositive hemophiliacs would be taking AZT, so it was necessary to try to separate out those two factors. And luckily, we have a little bit of information to do that. We can read the label for AZT from the manufacturer, GlaxoSmithKline. They agree that the drug can cause symptoms of AIDS. Quote, "It was often difficult to distinguish adverse events possibly associated with administration of retrovir, or AZT, from underlying signs of HIV disease or intercurrent illnesses." So saying that the side effects are similar to the signs of HIV disease, which are AIDS, is basically saying that the drug can cause AIDS. One way to distinguish the effect of HIV from AZT is to examine the statistics on mortality in hemophiliacs before 1987, before AZT, and after. A paper by Darby showed that the mortality rate amongst severe hemophiliacs was quite low from 1978 to 1984, including both positive and negative hemophiliacs. However, in 1986, the death rate rose dramatically until it reached a shocking 13% of all severe seropositive hemophiliacs in the UK in 1994. 13% mortality in 1 year. That's huge. And it only declined in 1996, which is when AZT and other nucleoside analogs started to be used at lower dosages because of the introduction of combination therapy with the less toxic protease inhibitors. The death rate in moderate or mild hemophiliacs was even lower from 1978 to 1984, but starting in 1988 rose dramatically and also reached an annual rate of about 13% in this group of seropositives by 1996 before similarly declining. It's worth thinking about this a little bit. Why did the death rate rise in 1986 when AZT was not prescribed until 1987? Well, AZT was tested before it was approved. It wasn't tested for a long time, but it was tested. Hemophiliacs were seen as a target group for AIDS, and therefore they were quite likely to be given AZT before it was approved in an experimental method. Why did the moderate or mild hemophiliacs start to die later? Well, presumably because AZT was first prescribed to those who first tested positive and to those who had the most severe illness. AZT was not always given immediately that you turned HIV positive, but if your CD4 counts were low or you had symptoms, they would be. So a severe hemophiliac would be more likely to have symptoms, more likely to have low CD4 counts, and therefore more likely to start AZT earlier. So that would possibly account for a slight delay in the increasing death rate in moderate or mild. But it's also interesting that the death rate reached the same amount, and that correlates with it being caused by a drug. Because if people with severe hemophilia, people with less severe hemophilia are given the same drug, if the drug is toxic, they may die at the same rate. Of course, now it's too late to really examine this because we can't go back in time. And back then, people were not thinking about issues like, is AZT causing this? Is the decline in CD4 counts more related to the type of factor 8 that's being used? There is a little bit of evidence. For example, a paper by Godert, I mentioned him before, a 1994 paper found that, quote, "Adjusting for baseline and age, hemophiliacs who'd started on Zidovudine or AZT had increased risks, especially for AIDS, a 4.46 times greater risk, and death, 2.37 times." That's fairly clear. Without apparently realizing this significance, one hemophiliac is reported as recalling in 2008. So in 2008, he was looking back to the early days, 1987, when everything started changing. And he says, "From 1987, all we," that's hemophiliacs and their families, saw was people dying, said Alice Mackey. 1987 was the year that AZT was introduced. In the book Positive False by Joan Shenton, who has been a guest on the show several times, Sue Thricall describes the rapid decline of her hemophiliac husband after starting AZT in 1989. Although HIV positive, he was healthy and had no AIDS indicator diseases, but was advised to take AZT nonetheless. And like many hemophiliacs who took AZT, he's no longer around to give testimony, just his wife. An opposite type of evidence comes from seropositives who eschewed AZT and later similar drugs that remained healthy. A paper by Rosenberg noted one hemophiliac among a group of healthy seropositive people. Initial studies were performed in a healthy HIV-infected hemophiliac with 18 years of documented seropositivity. 18 years, I want to emphasize that. A normal CD4 T-cell count, and that was probably because he was on high purity factor 8, which started in the late 1980s, and a viral load of less than 400 RNA molecules per milliliter of plasma, who had never been treated with antiretroviral agents. The well-known U.S. virologist Jay Levy wrote, "A third category of infected individuals consists of the long-term survivors, also called long-term non-progressors, sometimes abbreviated LTNP, who have remained healthy with normal CD4 cell numbers for at least 10 years. These asymptomatic people can also be found among infected hemophiliacs. The reason for this lack of progression in the absence of treatment has not been explained." This is a Levy paper from 1998. Absence of treatment might actually be the explanation for why they are healthy, and the high purity factor 8 might be the reason why their CD4 cell counts are normal. So those who made it through 1987, 1988, who were put on high purity factor 8 before they became HIV positive, probably stayed HIV negative, and their CD4 counts probably stayed high. Anyway, this evidence makes it quite clear that while infusion of impure blood products was causing health problems in hemophiliacs, at about the same time that high purity blood products were being introduced to resolve this problem, a highly toxic drug was also being prescribed that among those already HIV positive wiped out the gains. Hemophiliacs who resisted the fear of HIV and refused AZT appear to have remained alive despite being seropositive. And of course, those who would have become seropositive on intermediate factor 8 in 2, 3, 4 more years, who were switched to high purity factor 8, may never have become HIV positive and therefore never pushed to go on to AZT. So, transmission of HIV in blood products. We're unaware of any evidence that infectious HIV has ever been found in any blood products for hemophilia. Studies claiming that different treatments of blood products reduced or eliminated the risk of HIV infection generally assumed that HIV was present in fresh blood and that so-called HIV antibodies could only be generated by infection with HIV, as opposed to transitioning to blood products with dramatically lower amounts of immunogenic proteins, resulting in fewer false positive results. For example, one important study from 1989 by a guy named Schimpf simply showed that there were no HIV seroconversions in hemophiliacs treated with factor 8 concentrate that had been heated at 60 degrees for 60 minutes. They did not show that HIV was present in the blood products before heating, and they did not have a comparable control group. Absent any evidence of infectious HIV in factor 8 or other hemophiliac blood products, upon which the mandate of the inquiry is founded, the concept of infected blood is meaningless. That's not to say that harm was not done to hemophiliacs, as discussed below. The mandate of the inquiry is to examine responsibility for the transfusion of HIV-infected blood into hemophiliacs in the 1980s and 1990s, under the assumption that blood was infected and that the infection caused the illnesses and mortality that were seen. However, what actually happened was that belief in an unreliable antibody test for HIV led to a panic that led directly to the approval and prescription of AZT. The blood of hemophiliacs was contaminated, but with it, the impurities in, quote, intermediate purity factor 8 and by AZT, not HIV. I guess I'm stretching it to say that AZT contaminates the blood, but it certainly destroys the blood. What persons and organizations were responsible for convincing the majority of the world that HIV existed and was a serious threat? What persons and organizations were responsible for approving an unreliable antibody test that, even if reliable, could not prove current infection? What persons and organizations were responsible for approving and prescribing the ineffective and highly toxic drug AZT? We cannot comment on whether the transition from intermediate to high purity factor 8 was as quick as reasonably possible, but this is certainly an area worth pursuing. So, in conclusion, the infusion of contaminated blood products set off a chain of events that led to a holocaust of hemophiliacs. The contamination was not, however, a virus, but impurities in the factor 8 and other blood products that caused immune suppression, and diseases of immune suppression such as pneumonia. This was easily confused with the new concept of AIDS, which occurred mostly among gay men and IV drug users, but who were immune suppressed for different reasons. Tragically, at about the same time the blood supply was being cleaned up by a transition to high purity factor 8, HIV-positive hemophiliacs were being prescribed the deadly drug AZT, which resulted in the decimation of those who accepted the prescription, with death rates of about 13% of all HIV-positive hemophiliacs in 1 year, regardless of the severity of the hemophilia. If you would like a copy of this letter that I sent to the UK Inquiry, I'd be happy to send it. It includes citations for all the papers that I referenced. And if you're really interested and want to see the actual papers, I think all of them I can provide to you. So please write to me, david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, and tell me what you'd like to receive. I'd be happy to share this with you. I'd also be happy to receive your comments. And one word on words, because I like words, as you probably figured out. I used the word decimate, which is actually often misunderstood. My understanding of the word decimate came from a habit of the Roman army that when there was a mutiny, they would line up their soldiers, and the Romans loved tens, so I think they had them in groups of 10 or 100 or whatever, and they would execute every 10th soldier. And the other 9 would presumably not want to mutiny again because of what happened to their comrades. So randomly, they choose 1 out of 10. So actually, a 13% death rate in 1 year is more than decimation, if you want to be pedantic about it. That's your word of the day. Okay, time for a couple of other somewhat related or unrelated issues. Vaccination is still in the news and probably will be until all the mandatory vaccination mandates that are possible to impose have been imposed, and then things will die down. Unfortunate for all the children who will be injured by the overuse of vaccines. I saw a tweet by a man going by Ian Fields, MD. I assume that he's a genuine doctor. My mother died of cervical cancer. She was a single mother who left behind boys aged 6 and 8. Nothing could ever prepare you for that loss. I will die on a hill wishing everyone would vaccinate against HPV. It would have saved my mother and would have changed my life. I certainly have sympathy for anybody who lost their mother at a young age. It's not easy at any age, but 6 and 8 is incredibly young. I'm fortunate to still have my mother at the age of 90. She's 90, not me. But it's not true that vaccination against HPV would have saved her life. At least it's not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I replied that cervical cancer incidence has risen in the UK, for example, among the age groups of young women who mostly have been vaccinated. The vaccine has never been shown to reduce cancer rates. And I supplied a graph based on UK official cancer statistics that shows that because in the UK vaccination occurred at a young age, the first vaccinated women turned 20 around 2010. And so I was looking at the age group 20 to 24 for the incidence of cervical cancer. The percentage vaccinated increased each year from 2010 as more vaccinated women aged into the 20 to 24 year old group. So I think they started vaccinating some children as old as 17 or 18, but most were vaccinated at the age of 12 or 13. So it took about 8 years for them to become old enough to show up in the 20 to 24 year old age group. So there was just a couple of percent in 2010, but by 2014, 57% of women aged 20 to 24 had been vaccinated approximately. And that's the last year for which I've been able to get statistics on cervical cancer in the United Kingdom, which is by itself interesting. They seem to be reluctant to update their list of cancer statistics for some reason. It's notable that in 2011, the rate of cervical cancer started to increase from 2.9 cases per 100,000 that year to 3.3 in 2012, 4.1 in 2013, and 4.3 in 2014. But I quickly got a response from one Jason Hardaway. Quote, 30 seconds on Google proved this statement incorrect. Citing a paper, well, I should say an online article, HPV vaccines cut cervical cancer rates, study shows. Perhaps he should have read more than the title because the title is wrong. It's misleading. The article, which is not a scientific paper, is based on a scientific paper that has the title, Trends in Human Papilloma Vaccine Types 16 and 18 in Cervical Precancers, 2008 to 2014. That's it. Trends in precancerous lesions, many of which regress and never become cancers. It's certainly not unreasonable to hypothesize that reductions in precancers will result in a reduction in cancers, but it's not a sure thing, especially if there is something in the precancers that become cancers that's different than those that don't and less amenable to the effects of the vaccine. Anyway, he of the quick tweet with less than 30 seconds research then became silent. On a completely different topic, a school in San Francisco is about to commit an art crime by painting over a mural depicting the life of George Washington. It's a controversial mural because it shows him standing over a dead Native American and an enslaved African American. However, it's known by even those who want to destroy the mural, because it's a mural, it's not possible to move it, that this was actually a criticism of white imperialism, not celebrating murders of indigenous people and the enslavement of black people. Interestingly, the artist Victor Arnatoff was a student of Diego Rivera. Diego Rivera was also a muralist and also a communist, like Arnatoff. And Rivera was also the husband of famous painter Frida Kahlo. Rivera also had controversies over subversive messages in the art. So when black students complained in the 1970s about this mural, the solution was to put up another piece of art in a response, which seems like a sensible approach. So black artist Dewey Crumpler was commissioned to paint a mural showing natives and African Americans in a more positive light. The problem now is that we apparently can't interpret art. We have to see it at face value, so that if some student walks by, sees a dead Native American on a mural of George Washington, takes it at face value and is offended, then we can't say, look, we need to examine the art and see what it's really saying, not just what it appears to be saying. It's just like on a perhaps less sophisticated level, a parody. Somebody might imitate a famous politician. That doesn't mean that they're supporting that politician. It's usually pretty obvious that they're antagonistic towards that politician and they're making fun of them. Art tends to be a little bit more subtle in their approach, but we know from the life of the artist and from the intent of the artist and from looking and thinking at the art that it was actually criticism of white imperialism, not support for the murder of indigenous people and the enslavement of blacks. We should, in a school, be trying to educate people and encourage students to actually think about things, to encounter difficult realities of history and different ways of portraying responses to that. There certainly is art that is laudatory. a statue of a Confederate general that was put up during tense relationships between white and black Americans is a provocation. It's basically saying, you might have thought you won the Civil War, but you didn't. We're still in charge. That's very different from a piece of art that's showing a subversive message that is actually going against criticizing the history of the country. Also this week, journalist Andy Ngo, and I apologize if I didn't quite pronounce that right, was attacked by Antifa in Portland, Oregon. He's a known conservative journalist, also gay and a minority, if that matters, who I disagree with on many issues. I think he is prejudiced against Muslims, for example. But I think that's irrelevant. He was milkshaked, which I guess sounds humorous, but the police have indicated that the milkshake might have included quick drying cement, which could be toxic, although most people say it would never dry and harden. He was bruised, cut, and may have suffered a brain bleed. So fairly serious injuries. Mainstream journalists were divided. Those on the right, not surprisingly, were sympathetic, and they might not be sympathetic to injuries to the, quote, Antifa, or to other people seen as progressives or less leftists. Many in the center were more thoughtful, not all, maybe half, recognizing that even if you disagree with a journalist's positions on everything, it's not justifications to harm them. Some resorted to whataboutism. For example, what about those people harmed because an article by Andy Ngo motivated bad people? But if one criticism of the far right, a justified criticism, is that neo-Nazis and their ilk are violent, I don't see how being violent against a journalist is helping make the case that progressives, Antifa, etc., are on the right side. They can't even claim in this case that it was defensive violence. If Andy Ngo showed up with a club or a gun or some other weapon, he would no longer be a journalist and it would be different, although I'm not promoting violence on either side. But he only showed up with a camera and a tape recorder, and some people say those were stolen from him. Violence usually results in unintended consequences and a backfire, and all it's doing is producing empathy and sympathy for Andy Ngo, which is ironic for the people who hate him. People who despise him might try outrighting him rather than beating him up. Thank you for listening to episode 224 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth, one word, on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.